Welcome to the State of Sound podcast, produced by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, a companion series to the blockbuster exhibit, The State of Sound, a world of music from Illinois, now playing at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum.
Chicago in 1972. They're known for blending elements of hard rock guitar and acoustic guitar, synthesizers mixed with acoustic piano, upbeat tracks with power ballads, along with musical theater that has attracted fans for decades and continues to this day with a busy summer tour schedule for 2021. I'm Joe Crane. This is the State of Sound podcast. One of the founding members of Styx, James Young, known to friends and fans alike as JY, plays guitar, contributes lead and backing vocals for the band, even plays the keyboards from time to time. JY joins us for the State of Sound podcast. Welcome, JY, from Based on Your Schedule, somewhere on the road out in Ohio this morning.
I guess we are. Where are we? Let me see here. What does this say? We're in Dayton this morning, and then we'll play here to play this afternoon, and then on to York, Pennsylvania tomorrow, then off to some balloon festival just outside of New York in Somerset, New Jersey, and they tried to get me to go up in a balloon with a New York City DJ, and I said, you go first. No, thank you.
Probably a smart idea. I bungee jumped one time, and I regret that to this day. I'm like, what was I thinking?
Well, you're putting your... putting your life in the hands of someone else, and I'm too valuable to too many loved ones to go out and do something silly at this late juncture.
Yeah, maybe 30, 40 years ago, you'd have probably done it.
Absolutely. I was, you know, we live and learn.
Yeah.
Mostly the hard way.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're glad to have you with us on the podcast. And let's start with the guitars from you and Tommy Shaw that are on display, literally just about 30 feet away from where I'm sitting right now. Maybe you can speak for Tommy about his guitar too, a 1969 Les Paul, but please tell us about your guitar, a 1989 Kramer that you've loaned for the exhibit, and what makes it special for you?
Well, that guitar is kind of unique to its time frame, and I was a Stratocaster guy from the very beginning. I'm a huge fan of Jimi Hendrix, so I performed live 5 times, going back, you know, to the late 60s, 67, 68, and 3 times in 69, I think, or maybe once in 70 before he passed. But I was a Stratocaster guy, and but all of a sudden, I don't know, then I really, Stratocaster with its pickups other guitars, such as the one that, you know, Tommy plays, a Les Paul. Well, that's got double coil, and the Strats typically are single coil, and they have a very different sound. And I said that I needed to have that sound in my artillery as well. I bought a Les Paul, but then I wasn't able to get the kind of stuff I liked out of my distortion device. So there was a new technology that came out in the late 80s where they have it's a little electronic circuit where it allows your guitar to feedback, and I can mimic Jimi Hendrix on all my guitars that have this thing, and because he was my hero and my idol. This particular Kramer you have was one of the first ones that the original one I used was actually made by a college classmate of mine, Dave Yoshinari, who was a graduate of Illinois Institute of Technology, where I was. He was electrical engineering. I had aerospace engineering, and he went on to do great things in a number of different companies, and still is a resident of the North Side, I believe. But this particular Kramer guitar that's there, I bought it. I just had never played a guitar like that before, and I go, wow, you know, how did they come up with this thing that really allows me to do Hendrix without having to have any external devices? I can just plug in any amplifier and sort of get the benefit of that. So I went right away and bought it and used it on, I was making solo records in the late 80s and into the 90s. And certainly the tour that we did in 91 with Styx, I used this. And also in the sort of quote unquote reunion tour of 96, I used it, and then we did record a record with the album, which title escapes me, in that time frame as well, that I used this guitar on.
Very cool. So, and the 1969 Les Paul that Tommy has loaned us, I understand it has an interesting story on it, that apparently the neck that you see is a replacement neck, because apparently the original, he ran over with his car. Were you there for that, or do you know the story on that?
You know, I've heard that story, but usually that story is told after we've had a few adult beverages, and so I'm vague on the details.
hey, it's rock and roll, right?
You're entitled to, actually, in small quantities, alcohol is actually good for you. So.
There you go. Well,
stick to the small quantities.
Exactly. Everything in moderation.
Including moderation.
There you go. Now, let's talk about Styx. Can you believe, JY, that it's been nearly 50 years since Styx was formed back in 1972?
Well, we battled. Actually, we had the lineup a little before that, and it took us a little while to actually, get to the point where we got a recording contract from One Nickel Record, which is a local-based thing distributed by RCA, and Bill Trout, who was a guy who had sort of discovered the Shadows of Night and helped make Gloria into a hit for them, and an amazing, brilliant move on his part. We signed a recording contract with Wood Nickel Records, and that recording contract was signed on February 22nd, 1972. So the 50th anniversary of that will be 2/22/22.
Wow.
Coming right up.
That's pretty cool that you've got all those numbers lined up.
That's about as high as I can count.
Yeah. So. Were you thinking about that 50 years ago? Like, hey, 50 years from now, when we have our 50th anniversary, it'll be 2/22/22.
I'm not sure I was thinking 50 hours ahead, let alone 50 years. So.
Yeah. Well, of course, Styx can trace its family tree, if you will, to 1961, when Chuck Panozzo and his late twin brother John formed a band called the Tradewinds, later to be known as TW4, short for There Were Four. Ironically, when you joined that band in 1970, the band grew to five. So obviously, right, at some point you had to change the name. That makes sense. But when you joined the band, take us back to those early years, right before and in the early years of Styx, what it was like as the band evolved into what it became.
Well, I was involved with my younger brother, Rick, who passed away, and we had actually taken the band I had called the Catalinas had taken third place in a battle of the bands down at Navy Pier in 1975. We got a chance to travel to Canada and all over Europe. I walked on Carnaby Street in 67 in London, where the Beatles, of course, held forth, not that we saw them. But and that band actually was going along, but the first rock festival in Illinois was at Kickapoo Creek. Irving Azoff, well-known Illinois native.
From Danville?
Danville. Son of a Danville pharmacist. He, along with a couple of other guys whose names I'm not quite sure of, put on this first rock festival at Kickapoo Creek. And the band I had with my brother, that was sort of our shining moment. We got a standing ovation in front of 10,000 people on a Friday afternoon and playing original music. But after that show, two of my bandmates came to me and said they were joining Jehovah's Witnesses. And I was about to graduate from college, and my brother still had a few years to go. And so that broke up that band. So I needed to find a band that was working. And the TW4 guys, the Panozzo brothers and Dennis and John Cerluski, were used to having a two-guitar lineup along with Dennis on keyboards and John and Chuck on drums and bass. And so they had heard me play before, but Dennis told me I was the most arrogant person he'd ever met. And they didn't do original music, and so I was a little bit arrogant. I will admit it. And and ultimately, they decided, I just said, I just have to play my one trademark song, which is Foxy Lady by Jimi Hendrix, because I had this distortion device that my friend made for me in college. And that was a unique device. And the Yoshinerator, we called it after the man who made it, Dave Yoshinari. And so ultimately, we tried putting my band back together with my brother, and I just couldn't seem to find anybody. I was shocked and no one was interested. So these guys made me an offer to go work with them. And so I did that. And the next thing you know, we started writing music, and I brought a song called Best Thing that Dennis helped me finish. And that was our first single on Wood Nickel. And that's, I think, the song that got us our deal. So ultimately, then the, all of a sudden, based on, you know, the music that we were writing and creating, and a manager that was related to Dennis by marriage had sort of been done a good job of getting us things and kind of put us in front of the right people, that we got signed by the guy that had made The Shadow of the Night a hit, Bill Trout. And they were distributed by RCA, and Jerry Weintraub was a kind of a silent partner in the whole thing. So that was a great thing. And as I said, we've signed that contract on February 22nd, 1972.
Wow. Almost 50 years ago. So, you know, I would go back to your comment that you were considered arrogant. I would say, no, you were considered confident.
Supremely confident.
There you go. Well, speaking of that record deal, as I understand it, you played a big part in helping the band land that first record deal. Is that right?
Well, I believe that is the song that I brought in called Best Thing that Dennis helped me finish, that really caught the ear of the record company. And that was our first single to be released.
Love seemed to be the best thing that I ever had. Your love seemed to be the best thing.
Started at number 88 one week, and then it was 88 with a bullet, and then it was 88 with an anchor, and then it was gone. The first single got there, and that was, so I mean, it's credited as a co-write with me and Dennis, but it was the genesis of it was me. Mm-hmm. So based now, on my lovely wife Susie.
Now, which, by the way, you guys are I believe celebrating or close to celebrating the 50th anniversary as well. Is that right?
In my marriage, indeed. Yes, we got married. We got the recording contract in February. We moved in, living without a marriage license for about 6 months, and then to my parents' chagrin, and ultimately 6 months later decided, well, so we got married about 8 months after the recording contract, and have stayed married to her. Now that'll be 50 years coming up, 49 and counting.
Well, congratulations on that. Now, not soon after Styx was formed, you guys had an opportunity to open for the late legendary David Bowie at a concert in Kansas City sometime around October, November of 1972. I've read that experience of seeing David Bowie in concert with his commanding presence and his theatrics on stage made quite an impression on the band, and as a result, the approach of Styx to live performances going forward.
Well, Bowie was an unknown, and he was just playing whoever would come to see at that point in time, and showed up in full battle regalia, the Spiders from Mars outfits. And we shared backstage, but they wouldn't allow us backstage to even be near him. That was part of his deal. And he went straight from the stage back into the limousine and out of there. But there was David Bowie right there in the Soldiers and Sailors Auditorium in Kansas City. And so that was certainly inspirational for us to see him and do what he did. Yeah. Or at least set the bar very high.
Now, the first song to break through for Styx was Lady. Not exactly an overnight success by any means. It was on the band's second album, came out in 73. Didn't get radio airplay until 1974, and then finally charted in 1975, eventually reaching number 6 on the Billboard Hot 100. As I said,
is that it did. Lady did not chart nationally, but regionally, there are certain radio stations back then. It was not the conglomerates that were programming half the stations in this side of the country, and the other half was some other conglomerate. Mm-hmm. You know, there was very independent ownership, so radio stations would play what they want. So we snuck in a few places, and the irony is that Billy Bob Thornton, who's become a great friend and is a native of the state of Arkansas, Little Rock, Arkansas, somehow that song went to number one in Little Rock.
Wow.
We went down there to play, and Billy Bob Thornton was in the audience when we first played Little Rock, Arkansas in 1973. and it remains a Styx fan to this day.
That's impressive. Now, you're talking about the radio airplay being picked up on different radio stations. One of the stations that was crucial to the success of that song and keeping your career moving forward was Chicago's WLS. Back at the day when people still listened to music on AM, it was an AM top 40 with a booming 50,000-watt signal that covered a good chunk of the U.S. and Canada at night. I've heard it told, JY, that one of the WLS DJs, I believe Jeff Davis, heard Lady playing on a jukebox at a pizza joint and loved it so much he convinced his boss to let him play it on a show. And the song soon became a big hit with their listeners. And of course, that was a big thing for you guys. How much of that story is fact or fiction? I've heard it told a couple of different ways.
Well, you know, the specific cast of characters that did specific things, I don't know. But the truth of the matter is that somehow, someone who liked us or some dumb luck, as you described, that a DJ heard it on the thing and said, how come we're not playing this song? This is a great song. It's a local band. We should be supporting them. Somehow, just by staying out there and playing small places and doing whatever we could and running down to Little Rock, where we had a number one single to play every 6 months, someone at WLS ultimately convinced management there that they should give this song a spin. And it charted high there, and that kind of got RCA, which was a parent company of Wooden Nickel Records, who we were assigned to, got them actually finally spending money on it about two, 3 years after it was first released. And then it was number one in every city, every top 40 radio stations across country. It just didn't peak. It peaked on the East Coast and then it kind of faded, but then they got it finally going on the West Coast, but they couldn't get the West Coast convinced until the East Coast got it up to number one. So the idea is you got to get out, you got to get the whole country to number one, and then you're nationally, you are number one. So we were top 10 for a long time, top 30 for probably 6 months because of the transition that we did there. So, there's absolutely some truth there, and it very well could have been Jeff Davis.
Yeah. I'm Joe Crane. This is the State of Sound podcast. James Young, JY, guitarist, vocalist, co-founder of Styx, is our guest. Of course, Lady, now a song that endures as a favorite to this day. More importantly, it led to an even bigger label deal, as I understand it, that set into motion a series of albums, each one more successful than the last, and then built up to Grand Illusion, your first triple platinum album. And that had to be pretty big at that point to realize that, hey, we've got something special here.
It's there's dumb luck is involved in, I think, almost every success, that you're in the right place at the right time with the right person in the room that says that sees value in something you're talking about or something that you've done, and says, you know, you're mishandling this whole talent that you have. You need to change A, B, and C, and that's a process that sometimes, if you're in Los Angeles or New York, that can happen quickly. But if Chicago, we like to think of it as very important, but it's really not so arts-based as New York or Los Angeles is. And so therefore, it's a little bit more old school. We just had to keep slugging away, and it took some time, but we did it.
Yeah, and of course, after Grand Illusion, the next three albums also multi-platinum selling, and along the way, a couple of number one hits, including Babe, the number one album with Paradise. And take us through those years when Styx was really hitting on all the cylinders that any band would want to achieve in the late 70s and early 80s.
Well, it was a dream come true. We never did the tour bus thing because we weren't tour bus kind of people. We had private aircraft. I mean, we would fly jet planes, you know, to the West Coast and this and that and the other thing. But towards the end of all that, we did start flying in. We were ahead by 100, I think, in 81. It was with Paradise Theater. I think we had 100 sold out arenas across North America. We had a private plane. I mean, Boston had sort of peaked maybe a couple of years before we did, the band Boston. Mm-hmm. And they were flying around in a similar aircraft from the same company. So we'd sometimes get their flight attendant on our plane, and then sometimes vice versa. So we hear stories about those guys, and ultimately we did do some shows with Boston at some point in time. But the it was glorious, sold out shows, and you know, the record company's throwing parties for you and things like that, and people, you know, fans screaming, fans.
And a couple of Grammy nominations along the way for the band, as well as a couple of engineers involved on putting a couple of the albums together.
Barry Mraz, phenomenal, and God rest his soul. And we've got gold albums with gold singles plastered all over our walls. So and platinum to some cases, and some double and triple platinum.
Wow. And in addition to putting out an album at that time, just about every year during the 70s into the 80s, the band, of course, doing a lot of touring. You know, when you're doing that much touring and that much work in the studio, especially by the time Paradise Theater came along with a kind of a rock opera feel for its not only the album itself, but for the touring, between the albums and the touring, that just had to be exhausting at that time.
I had more energy then than I do now. And I don't know, it was so exhilarating, mm-hmm. to just watch it happen and to be, you know, to sort of you slug through the back alleys of showbiz until you finally they let you in the front door, and then the next thing you know they're flying you across the country and flying you to Japan, flying you to Europe. And I mean, I had a chance to go all the way and do interviews. I mean, Tommy Shaw wrote a song that was never really big in the States, but it's a song called Boat on the River from Cornerstone, and it became a huge hit in Europe, number one in Germany for like 8-10 weeks running. And because German radio is aimed eastward towards Russia, I've had people that have emigrated from Russia that said, oh, that was our favorite song, Boat on the River, we heard that on German radio going way back. It was a number one hit in Israel, a number one hit in Greece, and I got a chance to go to the Holy Land and do an interview there. I had a chance to go in Greece and drive by the Parthenon and then do a radio interview there and, you know, do some sightseeing. Wow. As part of the whole thing. So
a very cool experience. Yeah, I think that, you know, I think as we get older, exhausting comes to mind. But at the time, it was probably a lot more exhilarating and just enjoying the moment for sure. But it ultimately took a toll, just the constant, you know, one right after another and all that. So by what, 1984, the band parted ways for a while before getting back together around 1990.
Well, Mr. Roboto was a song that I didn't think the band should have done back then. And it was just such a drastic departure, mm-hmm. from what we were known for. And I said, you know, I just, but ultimately it's our biggest selling single, and it's the only single that actually sold a million copies of ours. Well, people stopped buying singles back then. They were buying albums.
Right.
And, so that Roboto is the biggest thing. And at least, I'm a co-writer on Renegade, which was on the backside. So,
now, 1990 comes along, Styx gets back together briefly at the start of the decade, then finally reforming in 1995 and continuing through today. At that time in the 90s, music, notably what we think of traditional rock music, was going through a lot of changes in the 90s. Tough time for a lot of established rock bands, but you guys seem to have adapted well and haven't looked back. You just keep rocking.
Well, we were very much in demand as a concert act, but you know, once they started digitizing records and it was the next generation, which generally teenagers tend to reject their parents' music. Mm-hmm. So it was with 20 years having passed, I wasn't surprised to see that, you know, it was virtually impossible for Styx or any band like it to even, you know, even if you'd been successful 10, 15 years before that, or even 5 years before that, the record companies weren't signing. So we put out some independent records and did a a few things that, you know, we battled through the 90s, but things changed, and so we turned into a touring act.
Yeah, and it's probably kind of gratifying and kind of ironic now that, as I've heard from other bands we've talked to, including REO Speedwagon recently for this podcast series, is that a lot of those, you know, where the kids in the 90s may have rejected the music that mom and dad loved in the 70s and 80s, some of those kids have come back around, and in many cases, the grandkids love that music now.
Yeah, I can't explain it. There seems to be some logic to it, but it, I don't need an explanation. I'm feeling the positive effects. We just played played live last night in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and, Midwestern people that in the 90s probably wouldn't have gotten arrested there, but last night had a really wonderful crowd and, singing along with every song.
That is very cool. That is very cool. Well, if we could change gears for just a little bit, JY, reflect on co-founder and bassist for Styx, Chuck Panozzo. Not only did he have to deal with the loss of his twin brother and fellow co-founder, drummer John Panozzo, back in the mid-90s, but he's been living with HIV for a number of years. From some of the things I've read, you've been inspired by his struggles and the way he's fought through his health issues, and you've been in his corner for support from the beginning to lend support.
Well, it's... I don't know. I'm an educated man. And when you go to college, you tend to become, I think, a little more liberal because you read more about how the world is not homogenized. It's all different people from all different stripes doing all kinds of different things that you've never heard of. And, you know, in some places, certain behavior is acceptable, other places it's not acceptable, and people can be very judgmental, and I don't know, Chuck had his own pathway, I had my own pathway, his brother had his own pathway, we all do, and for Chuck to come down with HIV and admit, you know, come out in the open as a gay man, took a lot of courage, I would say. Mm-hmm. But I some of my best friends in the world, as I've gone through time, and particularly in the entertainment business, are of the opposite persuasion than I have. But that doesn't mean we can't work together and do phenomenal things. And they tend to be very artistic, as Chuck is, and in terms of the visual arts. So I felt like this is... I'm an educated, successful man.
I think
I got to stand up for my bandmate.
I think that's a great lesson for everyone. I'm Joe Crane. This is the State of Sound podcast. James Young, guitarist, vocalist, co-founder of Styx, is our guest. Our exhibit, State of Sound, A World of Music from Illinois, celebrates the rich diversity music that comes out of Illinois. Certainly Styx, a big part of that story. So what does it mean for you and the rest of the band to be part of a state that's produced such great music over the decades?
Well, I mean, Chicagoans and Illinoisans are a proud bunch, the land of Lincoln. And so I think, you know, we like to defend the other guys and the other gals. So I don't know. There's a great deal of pride in the city of Chicago. I'm a huge Bears fan. John Panozzo was a big Blackhawks fan, and actually got a chance through some connections and friends with our celebrity to go out and hang out backstage with the Blackhawks and then started going out drinking with them, which was a mistake because I could not keep up with them. But Doug Wilson, who was on the team back then, and Grant Mulvey Antonio Esposito was at his house 100 times. Dan Makita had many chances to hang around with him in that era. And Doug Wilson is general manager of the San Jose Sharks. We were out there. He and his wife are huge fans. She grew up in Chicago, Kathy. And so they'll come out to the show. So, I mean, we're really hooked into that. And I'm a huge Bears fan. And a crazy, wonderful story I have was a law firm that I was using in Chicago. Actually, Brian Bashnagel, who was on the Bears, he was a starting wide receiver at certain points in the 60s, but never really quite... he was never made the big bucks, but I think Brian still works for the team. But he became a friend of mine because he was working at this law firm, and he brought me into the Bears locker room, and I got a chance to shake hands with Jim McMahon, and there's Dan Hampton, who's a big Sticks fan from Arkansas, and Walter Payton I met, and ultimately cutting then to 1984, we had just had our Mr. Roboto Kilroy tour in 83. 84 was this tour with Michael Jackson, the tour with his family and the whole family. And because Sticks is Southsiders and Gary, Indiana isn't that far away.
Right.
And I think the Panazzo's dad actually worked in the mills, if not in Gary, right on the border over there. So and I was with Brian Bashnagel, who was Walter Payton's roommate in training camp. And so we happened to just see Walter, hanging around the ball yard for the Jackson thing, but he didn't, you know, he didn't look like anybody was escorting him. He was just out there. I guess he is getting the feeling the glow still even after he had retired. And so the guy that was the tour accountant for our tour in 83, the Kilroy Mr. Roboto tour, was now then he was the tour accountant for this Jackson family thing that they did across North America. So he said, "Hey, JY, you want to come back and meet the Jacksons?" I said, "I'd love that." And then all of a sudden Walter Payton shows up and he becomes part of my entourage. And so, and Walter Payton and Michael Jackson had never met before that. So I crow about the fact that I somehow, through some dumb white man luck, I was able to be the catalyst that brought these two guys together for the first time.
Wow, very cool story. I think that was the Victory Tour, if I recall, for the Jacksons.
Yeah, I may have the years wrong, but
84, 85, somewhere along in there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was it like, hanging out with the Jacksons? Because, I mean, there's, another iconic group, not exactly from Illinois, but, kind of just right across the border.
Right. Well, I mean, we didn't spend much time there, but they were, they'd all heard of Sticks. And, I mean, Michael was very quiet and reserved. Mm-hmm. But, no, I had a fun time talking to those guys and said, I probably, I feel like we're brothers in a certain way,
right?
That we've made music, and I mean, because Gary, Indiana is, it's really part of the greater Chicago metropolitan area, if I may phrase it that way. So I don't know. It was exhilarating.
Yeah,
and it's something I can talk about now. How many years later?
Yeah, about close to 40 years. Yeah, and over the years, it's been fun for fans to see Sticks collaborate so often with fellow Illinois rockers, REO Speedwagon.
Yeah. Well, Kevin Cronin grew up not far from where I grew up on the South Side. He grew up in Oak Lawn, but I was a Chicagoan, and I hadn't met Kevin, but he was friendly with Gary Loizzo, who was the lead singer in the American Breed, who has passed away a few years back, dear friend of ours, and was our recording engineer. And Gary was out on the road with us. So it just started to make sense that we had someone that could, introduce the guys and just kind of, keep peace in the camp. And we switched nights as to who closed and who didn't. Mm-hmm. And Arias, I'm sure, has probably sold more records than we have. I think we've sold more tickets than they have. But
not that you guys are keeping track of such things for a friendly competition.
Yeah, somebody's got to, two people stand in a room, who's taller? Well, I don't know, I don't know. It's friendly competition. You've said it better than I.
Yeah, and I think I heard an interview recently, I believe it was Bruce Hall from REO Speedwagon.
Great guy, love him.
Made a comment to the effect that, there was a time when, we were, always trying to, just kind of one-up the other bands that were Illinois or Chicago bands just for, the pride of saying we're the top band from Illinois. But he said, over the years, we just came to realize that, hey, these guys are great too. Let's all collaborate and everybody will come out a winner at the end. So I thought that was kind of a cool comment.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Speaking of tours, pandemic, of course, shut everything down, but I guess you've got to be glad to finally get back out on the road.
Amen.
And of course, from what you said last night, you had a great crowd and enthusiastic crowds. And I'm sure, how long have you now been back on the road since everything opened up?
Just a couple of months.
And everything going so far, so good.
Oh, yeah.
Good. And of course, you'll make your way to the Sangamon Auditorium here in Springfield coming up in November. So we hope you guys can come out to check the exhibit here when you come to town at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum.
Got to come see my guitar.
Yeah. Now, don't take it, you know, hopefully you still, you won't need it that night, but I guess if you, it is your guitar. So if you needed to play it, I guess we could let you borrow it for the night.
That guitar is, I love that guitar, but I was sort of shamed in by, you know, we have a, between the guys in our, the guitar players in REO Speedwagon and a guy that worked for us, Keith Marks, who was a great guitarist in his own right, but never quite succeeded, but he's done very well as a, you know, road manager and many other things he's gone into. Keith said, JY, you got to put that Kramer away and you got to get a Stratocaster and get it set up the way you, the Kramer's set up. They can do that now. I said, oh, they can. And so I got shamed into, you know, taking, actually took my old 63 Strat and which I'd attached all kinds of different things to it. It's got drill holes here and there. It's beat up and whatever, but I still love it and I still use it. It'll be fun. I must come see the guitar.
Very good. A final question, nearly 50 years for Styx. Of course, the anniversary coming up to 2222. What's next for Styx?
I don't have a clue. I mean, we're going to keep making records. We're going to keep writing songs. We're going to keep touring as long as we're physically able and people are willing to spend money to come see us. And because we have sort of, God rest and God bless John Panazzo's soul, but Todd Zuckerman is from the Chicago area, and some people think he's the best drummer on the planet. He's in the top echelon of drummers on the planet. He's just astounding. I stand next to him and watch him play, and I go, wow. So he's great, and Tommy Shaw is great, and Lawrence Gowan, who has replaced Dennis in this lineup, was a Canadian superstar, and he is he's a phenomenal keyboard player and a great showman and a great singer. I love the guys I'm with, and we have a bunch of fun, and we're doing our thing.
Sounds like a plan altogether. James Young, co-founder, guitarist, vocalist for Styx. Thanks for joining us, JY, on the State of Sound podcast.
My pleasure.
This has been the State of Sound podcast produced by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. To hear other episodes and more information about the exhibit, The State of Sound, A World of Music from Illinois, visit musicfromillinois.com.